welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. I've been working with self-managed super funds for over 15 years now, and when I first started dealing with them, they were rather a niche strategy for wealthy individuals. Now they're the retirement vehicle of choice for over a million Australians, and when you mention self-managed super funds, no one thinks you're talking about text messages anymore, which is a good thing. They're still a complex area though, and there are many strategies and many traps that people are not familiar with. Today I am joined by Peter Hogan, one of the original gurus of the SMSF sector, to talk about some of these. Peter is currently the head of technical at the SMSF Association, which is the peak body for professionals in the SMSF sector. He was previously national manager of SMSFs at MLC, head of technical at Colonial First State. He runs courses on self-managed super funds for the University of Adelaide, and he taught me everything I know. Don't hold him responsible when I get stuff wrong. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
It's Peter and I have worked together for a long time. This one should be quite relaxed, right? So, first things first, SMSFs tend to run pretty vanilla strategies. There are plenty of things that are available in an SMSF that are not available in a public offer fund. So in a retail fund or a corporate fund or an industry fund, an SMSF gives you much wider choice. Most people don't take advantage of all of those choices for one reason or another, but there are some pretty exciting things people should think about.
Yeah, it occurred to me when I was thinking about what we'd chat about today that one of the main things that most people say that they have an SMSF for is control, and it's control around their investments and what they do with them. And then when they get their SMSF, they're told, you know, they have to build this core portfolio and they have to hang on to these shares and they shouldn't trade them and they should think very carefully about how they build their portfolio and build cores and satellites and all the other different things.
Invest
for the long term, do all those sort of things. And sometimes it seems to me that people lose sight of the fact that part of the reason, or one of the big motivations for having an SMSF, is to trade and to enjoy themselves a little and to not irresponsibly. I'm not suggesting that at all, that they should simply buy a penny dreadful just because they can and they have some money. And I've seen too many SMSFs with a graveyard of penny dreadfuls at the bottom of the list of shares that they've purchased that are still sitting there at half a cent or something like that. They haven't quite got the heart to sell them, or if they could sell them at all. But nevertheless, one of the things that people enjoy about their SMSFs is having a portfolio of direct shares that they can trade and they can look at. So while I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't have your core stocks that you hang on to because they drive good yield and all the other reasons you might buy them, it's also something that I remind people that perhaps research and spend some time picking some unusual stocks, maybe only two or three. Mm. It might only represent a small percentage of your portfolio, but get on to the research areas, websites that you have, and NAB Trade has theirs, and they have a terrific research area. And pick some stocks that you find interesting, industries that you understand, perhaps or have a bit of a feel for, perhaps maybe even industries that you don't know much about, but like to know a bit about it, and having a bit of interest in the company heightens that desire to know a bit more about it. Whatever the motivation, and perhaps think a little bit more and enjoy the fact that you've got an SMSF and you can do a bit of trading and it's only a very small percentage of the fund, so we're not talking about risking your retirement.
Yeah, don't put 95%
stuff. And certainly I'm definitely not talking about highly geared type arrangements or managed funds or whatever. It's really just a matter of perhaps getting that little bit extra out of your share portfolio in a good way, hopefully.
I love that. And I've had some interesting conversations with my husband who we have a very structured investment portfolio, and we've been fairly, very careful when we set it up, very thoughtful about where we wanted all of our money to go. But he's in the investment industry, and he would come home and he knows an analyst, or is very close to an analyst in the luxury goods area. Which is a pretty interesting field. All of the stocks are based offshore. There's no luxury goods I can think of that are listed in Australia, but we can access those markets via the platform. So he can buy directly in the US, and he'd come home and he'd say, Ralph Lauren's looking really good value. Now that's both a personal and a professional perspective, you know. So he knows a bit about Ralph Lauren as a retailer and also as a consumer. And so he'd say, oh, it's looking really good value. I was saying, well, you know, if you want to buy some, you can. It that's what our portfolio is for. So that was the sector of choice for him.
Yep.
It was the one whatever that he works, wanted to have good. A bit of a play with. It was it's a bit absolutely. Of fun. It's a really good point for a lot of people who, you know, if you have an interest in cars, for example, plenty of people who are into motor racing, you know, there are big companies that invest in this
sure,
sort of stuff.
Absolutely. And I mean that's one of the basics, isn't it? Is to invest in a company where you understand as much as you can the business that you're actually investing in. And can take a view about whether it's when it's a good time to be in, and perhaps when it's not such a great time to be in as well. Mm-hmm. And you still need to set all those parameters. You know, your bottom price that you got is absolutely should
still an investment. Yeah,
still an investment. Investment still needs to be treated that way appropriately. But it's you add a bit of interest to what you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. So it's a proposed piece of legislation. And I really like your perspective on it. So I've written an article on it saying that I've got some reservations. I think for a lot of people it sort of adds risk rather than adding opportunity. Yep. You have a different perspective. I think it's really cool to talk about it.
Yeah, so we chatted about this before, that this proposal by the government announced in Budget Night that the number of SMSFs would go from a maximum of 4 to a maximum of 6.
So the number of trustees.
And members, yes. Both together. So, and all directors of the corporate trustee, however you've got your funds set up. Mm-hmm. And so putting aside any legislative complications, we don't have any law and on this, and my memory is now, Budget Night seems like such a long time ago now, it's not really, is 1 July 19, I think. I could be corrected on that, but I think it's coming to effect. It's not proposed, certainly from 1 July this year, from my recollection. So we've got a bit of time to think about it, but a lot of discussion, quite rightly, has been raised about how this will complicate SMSFs even more so than what they are now at the moment, but it's something that just occurred to me. One of the biggest objections, I think, which is one that misses the mark, is one around, the idea, I suppose, is to bring younger members of your family, be their children, their spouses, whoever, into your self-managed superannuation fund, and that there are the benefits of increasing the overall assets of the fund under management. There's obviously, the government has openly said this is partly in a response to Labor's proposal to remove the refund of unused franking credits, so an opportunity to generate more income that's taxable inside the fund if you have more people in the accumulation phase, and so on. And whatever the motivation for putting it in, one of the often cited criticisms is that why would you want your children in your self-managed super fund telling you how to invest your money, and potentially blowing up your retirement savings. And, you know, the answer is, well, you can let them if you want to. I wouldn't recommend it. But nevertheless, investment choice is something that's alive and well. And people often forget that every individual member of a self-managed superannuation fund is able, within the broader investment strategy of the fund, to invest their share of the fund however they like.
Yeah. And have that separate.
And have that completely separate. And the returns on those investments, the capital growth and the capital losses, you know, realised or unrealised, the income generated in that portfolio can be specifically allocated to their account.
Yeah.
And so if you have...
You can document a separate investment strategy.
And you can even have a separate investment strategy if you feel that that's necessary. If it's too difficult to have a broad investment strategy that satisfies everyone's different... investment options that they want to take. So either is acceptable. It does make the fund a bit more administratively expensive to run because you're running, not legally, but almost separately, separate little portfolios which you have to account for income and growth separately. So it is like having a little sub-account inside your fund or whatever. So, but the administration software and so on that's being developed now is going to have to report all of that to the tax office pretty much on a member-by-member basis with, you know, transfer balance accounts and total super balance accounts and all these other sort of things are going to be reported. So member reporting is going to be pretty much a standard thing going forward, I think, anyway. So it is possible for you to say to your kids, listen, if you want to dive in and this sort of internally heavily geared sort of the Southeast Asian specky stock, whatever, go for it. And you can put your, you know, $2,000 into that if you like and have a great time and enjoy it. But we're not going to put our money into that. We're going to keep our money separately and we're going to keep on investing it the way we want to invest it as well. And if you have a great result, well then, well done. You'll get the whole entire benefit of that credit to your account. If you don't have such a great result, well then, it's only your account that's going to be affected by it rather than the fund as a whole. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's not, it is something that is only for self-managed superannuation funds. It doesn't apply to larger APRA funds. You know, you can choose a balanced style or a growth style or whatever, but you can't drill down to that sort of, that more detailed level that you can with SMSFs. And that's why people often forget about it. So it's something to keep in mind that you have that opportunity to continue to invest your money how you like. In the interim, you know, you can introduce your children to the share market in a way that perhaps they wouldn't.
Investments in general.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't have to, suddenly find themselves, saved up a whole pool of money. They've got this pool of money built up in superannuation. And again, I'm not suggesting you encourage them to treat it like play money my experience I think is that they lose some money and they start to go, oh, that wasn't a good experience. Maybe I should take this a little bit more seriously and think about it a little bit more. And it's a good opportunity, I think, to introduce in a controlled way, just what it is around investing and so on. To my mind, so many of the people who fall foul of the spruikers and be their property schemes or very dodgy managed investment arrangements or whatever is because they really haven't got a lot of experience in investing and understanding what's involved. And I think this is a great opportunity to give your children, regardless of their age, and I'm not necessarily talking about only adult or older children, you know, it could be someone in their 20s or
16 with their first job.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, why not?
I think it's a really important point because a lot of the people I meet professionally are in the profession because they were introduced to financial services and money at a young age, became really passionate about it and ended up wanting to work in the field. Mm. It didn't happen by accident. They didn't decide at 23 after finishing university and, you know, going to work, you know, oh, I tell you what, this financial services thing is fascinating. I should get onto that. They had some early experiences and they're very active in terms of their approach to investing, and that early experience, as you say, you've got plenty of time to fix things up if you make a mistake at 22, if you make a mistake at 52. And so that idea of introducing your kids, there's so much talk about financial literacy now and the value of educating children through schools and all of these things about wealth and money and the complexity of some of the systems and how do you ensure that people are equipped to deal with complex financial matters later in life. It's quite a straightforward way for parents to introduce them.
It is, and I mean, you know, to see your account balances go up and down is a great lesson. You know, you say to your kids, well, you know, your account balance is $5,000 this month at the end of the month. They go, oh, that's good, is it? And then they go, yeah. And then a month later you say, guess how much your $5,000 is worth now? And they go, oh, I don't know. And say, it's worth $4,700. Oh, is that bad? Well, no, not really. But it's, you know, it just demonstrates it goes up and it goes down. It's, you know, next month after that, hopefully it's $5,100 and it goes up and we add a bit, save up a bit more money and we put a bit more money in or whatever. But it's understanding that these investments move around and that you don't have a loss until you realise it as well. All those sort of lessons are hard to learn in theory, I think, but when you actually have some real dollars sitting there and you have those conversations, then it becomes a bit more tangible. Mm-hmm. So it's good. So I think, you know, the 4 to 6 members, you know, we all know 70% of SMSFs are 2-member funds.
Yes.
You know, 25% are 1-member funds, you know. We're talking about 5% of the total 600,000 SMSFs in the market have, have more than 2 members or 1 member in them. And so we're not talking about a huge rush, I don't think, of family members suddenly joining, but I think that it's an opportunity there for those people who feel that's something they want to do for their children, to introduce them to the markets, and it's a way of doing that with the cash flow that's already there, being supplied through the dreaded super guarantee levy. We all know we use the super guarantee levy for all sorts of things like providing insurance we couldn't otherwise couldn't afford, and all sorts of things. And this is another opportunity to perhaps use that money in a constructive way.
I like it. It's really cool. The only warning I would provide is that all trustees and all members are responsible for activities of the fund. So if your kids are irresponsible for any reason, and if you have any concerns, they will try to access those funds. And those sorts of things. So they haven't made a conditional release, obviously, because they're kids and they're perfectly well. Be very cautious about that. Sure. If this is an investment strategy and you are sure that they're very well equipped to ensure they comply with the legislative requirements, as well as wanting to get an investment lesson, great. If you think there's any risk at all, they're going to try to access their money or do something that is going to make your fund non-complying, not a great idea.
Absolutely, yes. Being a sole signatory of the funds. Generally, I haven't had a chance to have a great deep dive into the changes around the transfer balance caps and so on. Is that what you're thinking?
The only thing that I understand about it is it only applies where the person is over their cap and it's a related party loan and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And it's been, yes, not as difficult as what it originally was proposed to be, I think, which is probably the sensible result in the end to come through that because of the difficulties. You know, you're actually reporting as you make a repayment of your loan, then you have to report it as being a credit against your transfer balance cap and or your account. And so that meant a complicated regular reporting for those people who had gearing in place and so on. And so that I think to limit it to particularly, you know, one of the areas we suggested was where the mischief really is things like related party loans and and so on, where perhaps you're concerned about the arm's length nature of the arrangement anyway, and the likelihood that somehow there is going to be some manipulation, perhaps of an interest rate or something, in a way that makes it inappropriate to let people unreasonably, unfairly build up their pension accounts.
Yes.
By gearing up their pension accounts, basically doing it this way and then getting that increase without that corresponding credit against the transfer balance cap. So, yeah, it is an interesting development. I've really not had the opportunity at this stage to sort of sit down and think about all the ramifications, if any, for that. But no doubt that will be a focus going forward.
It clearly seems to have been brought in as an anti-avoidance provision. So,
yes.
For most people, this is irrelevant, right? It's which is good. So gearing still remains as an opportunity for people who are using it for the right purpose, right? Which is to grow their balance and to...
Yes, yeah.
So one of the most exciting reasons that people think about setting up an SMSF, it doesn't seem to be the reason that they people have one, but it is one of the things that piques people's interest is borrowing. So borrowing is difficult, if not impossible, in most public offer funds. There's a couple of funds that give you the opportunity to do it, and you can buy internally leveraged products within an ordinary super fund. But generally speaking, if you want to borrow to invest inside the superannuation environment, you are probably going to set up a self-managed super fund to do it.
Yes, yeah, indeed. And it is something that you do see a lot. You know, the statistics around the age groups of people who are setting up new SMSFs, for example, are trending to younger and younger ages. And so it's now the late 30s, early 40s sort of is a group that spend a lot of time setting up self-managed superannuation funds. We actually ran a trustee expo down in Melbourne a month or so ago, and we had a lot of people come through over the three-day period. And this is not typical of an SMSF person, but it did remind me of a young man that I had a conversation with there who didn't have a fund, but he was thinking about setting one up, and so he came over to chat about what was involved, and he sticks in my mind for the obvious reasons when I tell you what he wanted to invest in. He said, so I asked him how much he had, and he said he had about $80,000. And I sort of said, well, you know, that's... No, sorry. I asked him what he invested in, and he said property. And I went, oh, okay. So that prompted me to ask him how much he had, and he had $80,000. And then he sort of said, so is you really, if you're going to do this, you need to diversify. He said, oh, yeah, I'm going to buy Bitcoin as well.
I also was on doing a speaking tour with the ASX And I said when I gave a presentation, take a guess as to what my number one question is whenever I give a presentation. And people correctly guessed that it was borrowing to buy property. And then by the end of the speaking tour, it was borrowing to buy property and Bitcoin. But again, back to the point we were making, that is what people ask about. It's not what people necessarily do.
Yes, I did caution him to say that really, you know, it was a very high-risk strategy, and it was one that perhaps simply because because of the number of dollars involved and the fact that he was going to, if he could find someone to lend him the money, which was obviously another issue altogether, with those sort of dollars available inside the fund, that it was, you know, poor diversification and highly leveraged and geared. And he just sort of nodded and wandered off to have a chat to someone about setting one up. It was initially my problem. But certainly, it is an interesting one. And sometimes people do look for self-managed super funds to borrow, to get into the property market for the wrong reasons. Mm. It's more motivation to get into the property market than it is to necessarily set up a retirement savings plan and vehicle and so on. So certainly from that point of view, yes, it is. It is something that... Gearing is still gearing, whether you do it inside super or outside super. All the risks are still there, as well as the benefits.
We've got a few additional risks when you're inside super. One is, obviously, you've got to be able to manage the cash flow in the super environment, and that's quite tricky. So if I think about this guy with $80,000, you would imagine his contributions were not that high, and therefore the rental income from the property would have to cover all of the costs, which is not necessarily the case if you're highly leveraged. So the cash flow issue is a really big one, particularly if you can't rent out the property for any period of time. You've got to be able to get some money in there to keep paying your debt.
Indeed, that's absolutely right. So it's all those sort of things that need to be taken into account. And my comment around, well, you should have some other investments in the fund, were for other investments to generate cash flow, not...
Bitcoin's not going to get you a whole lot of cash flow, right?
No, that's right. So those general criteria still clearly apply in that area, and it is still an area of concern, I think. Maybe so, you know, particularly last year when the property market around the country was
tapering
hot.
Off, should we call it?
Well, it
tapering off since...
You know,
since
sort of
then.
September last year, it sort of peaked, you know, and so leading up that period of time, a lot of people felt that maybe they were going to, their opportunity to get into the property market was going to pass them by if they didn't get in, and so they were looking at all sorts of avenues to do that. And that anecdotally is something that we believe some people may have tried to use superannuation to sort of get into that market. And you know, the market has shown that their concerns, while real at the time, were you know, as always, the property market's come off. They waited now, and hopefully
they can't go up 20% year on year forever.
No. And they've actually come off a good 10 or 15% or whatever it is that they've come off since then.
Depending on where you are,
The one
type of property where this can be very attractive, and not to say that it's the quality of the property and your cash flow, you know, multiple issues you have to consider. And this is one of the areas where we strongly recommend people get advice, talk to someone who is well qualified, who has experience in this area in particular, and knows what they're doing and has a good record of managing these kinds of things. But business real property, it's still the business, right?
It still is, yeah. I mean, it's an opportunity at a whole lot of different levels, so that... if the business currently owns the property, they can still allow to sell it to their superannuation fund. If they want to contribute it, it becomes a little bit more complicated, but they can sell it to their fund. It provides cash flow to their business.
Which is
sort of nice to start off with. You don't have to sell it.
Concessionally taxed when you have to pay rent back to the super fund.
And then you get to pay rent on top of that, so you get a tax deduction for that. So it's like having another member contributing to the fund. As far as the business is concerned, the business has got money flowing to the fund, getting a tax deduction for it, and it's not limited to $25,000 a year like it is for everyone else. It's whatever the reasonable rental income is to pay for that particular property. You don't have to, I mean, the other thing I think that's not well understood, I think, by a lot of people is you don't have to transfer 100% of the interest in the property into the super fund. So it's quite acceptable for individuals or their business to own a percentage of the property, and their super fund as tenants in common to own a percentage of the property. So part of the rental income goes to the super fund, part of it doesn't. The downside is currently if you own it inside a company, your business is probably not paying rent to itself for the use of that property. When you transfer it into the super fund, obviously the business has to start paying rent. Yes. So there is a cash flow issue for the business itself, which needs to be taken into account. But that did tax deductible cash flow adding to the retirement savings of the principals of the business is very, very powerful, and one that I would always recommend small business owners consider.
Yeah.
And the only other thing at the other end of it is from a succession point of view, to make sure that you have a plan in place for when you're ready to retire and someone else has taken over, your children or other family members have taken over the business and running it and they're using that premises. Somehow you've got to make sure that's if need be, you can get that out of the self-managed superannuation fund in an appropriate way, such that your retirement nest egg is maintained.
Yes, you've got something to provide for your retirement. It's not right. You're not worried about the business premises anymore.
That's
you're
right.
Worried about
putting food on the family. Still got use of the premises for their business, ongoing family business or whatever. So that can get a little tricky. But generally, as a strategy, it has far more pluses and downsides.
Yeah, and borrowing made that one more feasible for some people who couldn't facilitate it any other way.
Yep.
So you kind of layer some of these strategies on top of each other.
Yep.
Get it right. Get some advice on some of these, because they
absolutely are
complex, and it is not worth taking any risks in terms of ensuring you've met all your legislative obligations. Definitely not. But seeing someone who knows this kind of stuff, they can stack all of these things together. And the other one you can stack in is the in specie contribution. So you're talking about the fact that an asset can be acquired from a related party of the fund.
Yes.
There's a big long list of things you can't acquire from related parties of the fund.
Absolutely.
And residential property would be top of that list, right? So if you own if you own an investment property in your own name and you would like your super fund to own that investment property, unfortunately you just cannot facilitate that transaction directly or even really indirectly. It's just prohibited, right?
Yes, that's
just prohibited.
Right. Yep.
But for business real property, you can sell it to your self-managed super fund, or you can transfer it in. But in specie transfer, we call it an in specie transfer, applies to other things as well, right?
Yes, that's right. So basically, there is a list, so listed securities, managed funds, all those sort of things can be acquired by the fund from a member or another related party as well. So all of those things are probably the more typical or easier to manage, because you can do them in amounts that the fund can afford to acquire in a single go. You don't necessarily have to gear. You can still gear into those as well. There are certainly products available which will facilitate the gearing into assets classes other than property as well, which make it all work well, and so on. But it's shares and so on. There's absolutely no reason why, if you've acquired shares personally, I know people who've inherited share portfolios from grandparents or parents or whatever, personally and all listed. On the Australian Stock Exchange or wherever, and one opportunity for them is to, there might even be an emotional attachment to the share portfolio, strangely, simply because of who they've inherited it from.
Yeah.
They perhaps want the cash, but they don't want to sell the portfolio, so a way of cashing it up personally is to sell that share portfolio to your self-managed super fund.
And you can also in specie it as a contribution, which is an interesting one, and again, this is one where you want to have a good accountant, a good administrator, a good financial planner, someone you're talking to who understands how the rules work and what the limits are. And also the paperwork. You were making a note about paperwork that I had not picked up on. So $3 million to the tax office for checking you got your paperwork right.
Yes, absolutely. That was a quiet little line in this year's budget. So the ATO was given some extra revenue to employ some additional staff to just check that for those people who are claiming this financial year and later financial years a personal tax deduction for contributions, either cash contributions or a specie contributions that you just mentioned into superannuation, that they've actually provided the appropriate notifications to the superannuation funds that have received those contributions, that they have an intention of actually claiming a tax deduction, so that the fund can recognise that as a concessional and therefore taxable contribution rather than a non-concessional after-tax contribution. If they're not provided the notice, then they're unaware of that. And technically, the tax law also requires that if that notice is not given, then the person loses their personal deductibility.
Yes.
As well. So it's hand in hand. It's not just a matter of getting away with claiming a personal tax deduction and not paying 15% tax on the contribution at the fund. It's quite the opposite, that you will lose that personal tax deduction as well. And so you'll end up with a personal tax bill that you perhaps didn't plan for and didn't expect either. Particularly if part of the motivation for that, perhaps as you might have realised some capital gains on an asset you've sold, and you're looking to shelter some of that capital gain by making a contribution into super, which is a good personal strategy, personal tax strategy, but one that only works if you're allowed to get the tax deduction in the first place.
Yeah, only works if you get your paperwork.
That's right, indeed. So it's a real wake up call. It was one that we expressed a lot of concern to Treasury about and to the government about when they sort of said they were thinking about providing personal tax deductions across the board, so not just. Used to just be to self-employed people prior to 1 July 17. Then they said, no, it's for anyone. One of the areas we raised and our concern about was the complexity to qualify for the personal tax deduction. And we're still talking to Treasury about trying to simplify the rules around when you do qualify. It's just to remove that 10%, what was called the 10% rule around, having predominantly non-personal exertion income, so non-salary and wages, mainly being self-employed. That rule's gone, but all the other requirements, which are quite lengthy, around qualifying for that personal tax deduction, means that it's not just a matter of making the contribution saying,
hey, I'm good,
I'm filling out my tax return. There's quite a few other issues that need to be addressed, and top of that list, obviously, is notification to the fund.
Yeah, the really simple things. They're not complex.
No.
You know, 99 people out of 100 will comply, but you have to do the work to ensure you comply.
Provided you know. And I think that's the thing, that a lot of people perhaps might be doing this I suppose in the past, most people who are likely to make claim to deduction are people in small business, therefore likely to have an accountant.
Yes.
Who's also versed in tax, who would sort of say, and by the way, you need to do this as well. Whereas if we're now talking about someone who's otherwise just earning salary and wages, who just perhaps even prepares their own return. Of course, the tax office virtually prepares it for us these days, let's face it. There's not necessarily the need to go and have someone give you a hand doing it. Maybe totally unaware that they have this extra obligation. They've just heard that they can, whatever their employer's contributed for their super guarantee, if they've got a bit of extra cash, they can put it aside. There was even some anecdotal evidence to suggest that a lot of employers who were doing salary sacrifice arrangements with employees, when this came in, were going to turn around and sort of say, well, we're not doing that anymore.
Wow.
And if you want to put extra money between super guarantee and $25,000 a year into super, you can do it and claim a personal tax deduction as well. So there might be a lot of people who've been in salary sacrifice arrangements where it was all taken care of.
Mm.
Now for this year, suddenly just finding themselves in a situation where they're making their own contributions off their own bat and not understanding what their obligations are.
So for people in that situation, just go to the ATO website. It's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
The critical thing is you do it.
Yes.
It's not that hard. You just need to make sure you do it. So get your notice of intent into your super fund as soon as humanly possible, and don't do a split or roll over to a pension basically before it's all done.
Leave the accounts all done. And you have to do that and provide that notice before you lodge your personal tax return.
Exactly,
that might be.
Yeah, so they're the critical things to get done, but it does matter. Particularly when the ATO has $3 million extra dollars to come and find out if you didn't do it. So that really does matter. Peter, one final one, because I think this is just fun and people tend not to be acutely across how it works. But effectively, there's nothing that limits what you can invest in an SMSF except how you use it. The one that comes up is artwork and wine and vintage cars and all of these really sort of, they're not listed assets for a start. These more unique assets. So how can you hold them in an SMSF? How do you treat them as investments?
You have to treat them as investments. And I think that's the difference now. People used to sort of treat them as a bit of fun on the side, you know.
Yeah.
My fund can buy one of these things and isn't that good? I always remember being very disappointed years ago when I realised I couldn't invest in a wine collection and my pension couldn't be half a dozen bottles of wine a week when I finally retired. All that sort of stuff is all fun to think about, but not really possible. And a number of changes were made quite a few years ago now that really said that these are legitimate investments, and this is the point. Of course, at that stage, I recall the government of the day was talking about banning collectibles. You know, so you just weren't able to own artwork, you weren't able to add wine collections or whatever, stamp collections. And clearly there's a very big market for these type of investments
as investments.
And so the rules have been fashioned in a way that basically says that you can own these assets still, but you have to treat them as investments. So they are not a coin collection that you can stick in your cabinet in your lounge room at home and admire while you're sitting down having a glass of red wine that your super fund might also own. Hopefully not. And look at them. So that personal use aspect rather than an investment aspect is the thing that is far more heavily policed now and controlled.
Yes.
So artwork, which is an example, which is commonly sort of problematic simply because people sort of knew that they had to pay for them if they wanted to hang them up in their lounge room or in their boardroom or whatever, but never, you know, I looked at a lot of self-managed super funds, I never saw a line showing rental for artwork received or anything like that. You know, there's certainly the accounts weren't prepared in a way that suggested that they were really probably being paid for appropriately. So all those sort of things are now clearly unacceptable under these new rules. And so certainly for people who understand those different asset classes well and can invest in them, you know, I remember having conversations with people who sort of say, well, I trade in stamps and I will buy a stamp from someone in London and I will never see it. And I will never touch it because the stamp will sit in a vault in some bank in London somewhere.
It's too precious to put in the post.
That's right.
Or on the post.
Or even take out of the safety deposit box. But, you know, I will buy and sell it and I can base it on provenance so I know that I'm actually buying something that's genuine, and I would trade it and I can make money doing that and I'll never touch it, I'll never see it. And that, to some extent, is how you need to feel about these particular types of investments if you do want to invest in them and trade in them with your self-managed super fund. So, you know, that's the caveat, I suppose, is to make sure that you treat them as proper investments, that there's no...
Yeah, and you have no personal...
Very arm's length.
Yeah, so you have no personal relationship. The one that I like to use is the vintage car where you lease it to a wedding hire company, for example, and they lease it out, they pay you rent for the use of it, and you never, ever sit in that car.
That's right.
You may watch it go past with a bride and groom in it, but you may not sit in it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's an investment.
Yeah.
And that comes really down to the core of what's called the sole purpose test, or why superannuation is around the retirement purpose that you have to have, which is that really the ATO in the self-managed super fund space regulates self-managed super funds and what trustees do. And they really do, when they look to see whether there is a core retirement purpose in the actions and the investment choices that trustees make, is to really look to sort of see, well, have the trustees been motivated by some sort of immediate benefit or you know, not returns, probably the right word, because you're mixing that up with an investment return, but some benefit they've got out of owning the asset now, which has got nothing to do with retirement. It's got everything to do with, well, I just want this asset and myself and the super fund will buy it for me and I'll just enjoy it. And that clearly is contrary to that retirement purpose and a very fundamental issue for superannuation and how trustees are judged on the investment choices that they make. And if they can't demonstrate that longer-term retirement purpose, and the ATO believes that there's a far more short-term benefit being derived by that investment that's got nothing to do with retirement, that's a real problem for trustees, I think, as well. And that's always been the overlay with these type of investments, and now we've got a whole lot of extra rules in the superannuation legislation on top of that as well.
Peter, thank you so much. It's always so awesome to have you along. Peter is the head of technical for the SMSF Association, which, as I said, is representative of all the professionals who work in this field, and trustees also to an extent, but the professionals. And there's a lot of people in the self-managed super fund sector now who do it themselves. You know, it's self-managed, right? Which is fantastic. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but there's real value in getting some expertise from someone like Peter and the people that he represents. So they produce a heap of fantastic content, which is often published. And we also try to take a pretty active role in ensuring that people who are doing it themselves get access to some of this information. It's sometimes complex, but there's lots of cool, fun things you can do.
Absolutely. Thanks,
Peter. Thank you so much. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, particularly if you want to hear anything else about self-managed super funds, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.